It's Monday, March 25th, and it's tough to beef up security when your entire military's in Ukraine. We start here. Russia suffers its worst terror attack in years.
Russian authorities so far have completely ignored the ISIS claim.
Now, with a nation grieving, Vladimir Putin is pointing fingers. They've already replaced one House Speaker.
She's going to try to get rid of Speaker Johnson.
But could a new congressional spending deal throw the GOP into chaos again? And after weeks of speculation, Princess Kate reveals her cancer diagnosis.
This, of course, came as a huge shock.
The message from her and the message between the lines from the whole family. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. When you're waging a war in another country, you want to make it clear you've got your home country under control. After all, in any war, you're going to have skeptics asking, should we really be doing this now? Well, those skeptics get a lot louder if you can't protect your homeland. To that end, Vladimir Putin has gone to great lengths to make sure everyone in Russia knows he's in control.
Спасибо. Спасибо большое.
He recently engineered an election with no real opposition that would ensure his landslide victory. He's cracked down on dissidents. He put down an attempted coup, the leader of which is now dead.
President Putin ordering Wagner mercenary fighters to swear allegiance to the Russian state.
And yet, clearly, he did not have control over this.
The smoldering aftermath of one of the deadliest terror attacks in Russia's recent history.
On Friday, gunmen burst into a Moscow concert hall, opened fire, and then set the entire place ablaze. As of this morning, at least 137 people are dead, more are hospitalized, and people are demanding answers. Thus far, Putin has blamed other countries for this, Ukraine, even the U.S., but this has all the markings of an attack by ISIS, which Russia had been loudly warned about by the U.S. before this even unfolded. Just a warning, some of the sound here is graphic and disturbing. With that, let's bring in ABC's foreign correspondent Patrick Reval, who used to be based in Moscow, by the way. Patrick, can you just walk us through what happened?
Hi, Brad. Yeah, I mean, as you say, this was a horrific terror attack, and it is one of the most deadly terror attacks to hit Russia in its modern history. Right now, the death toll stands around 137 people dead. There were over 100 people hospitalized as well, at least from this attack. Four men, very heavily armed with assault rifles, stormed into a mall with a concert hall where a packed rock concert was going on. And these four men entered and began just shooting people. There are just awful videos circulating online where we see just these men firing point-blank range at people. They break into the auditorium, and people obviously at first aren't sure what's going on. And then panic just breaks out.
I was in the concert hall at this moment, and this uncertainty, where to go, what to do, it scared me the most, as every person there had no idea what was happening.
At the same time, it appears one of the men was setting fire to the building. A huge blaze breaks out, and this is a massive mall. It's one of the largest malls in Moscow. Eventually, the roof collapses, and the video that we see of the aftermath now is just this enormous auditorium that I believe has capacity for several thousand people, just completely torched and collapsed. Yesterday, we saw a day of national mourning in Russia. We saw really very, very big crowds of people lining up to lay flowers outside the mall.
It is a tragedy that has affected our entire country.
There are also very long lines of people giving blood for the very large number of wounded. But, you know, I think there's a huge sense of shock in Russia over this attack. I think there's also a deep sense of confusion over who did it.
Yeah, who did do it, Patrick? We've been told ISIS from non-Russian authorities. I didn't even know that ISIS had beef with Russia necessarily. I mean, what did happen?
So a group called ISIS-K has claimed responsibility, and ISIS-K is basically the regional branch, a regional offshoot of ISIS that is in Central Asia and that is mostly based in Afghanistan. And obviously, Central Asia borders Russia, and there are a very large number of Central Asian nationals in Russia. And this group has tried to target Russia for a long time. Back in, I believe, 2022, they set off a bomb outside the Russian embassy in Kabul. And, you know, ISIS, as I say, for a long time has targeted Russia, in part because there's been a very long-running Islamic insurgency in the Caucasus, in Chechnya, but also because Vladimir Putin intervened militarily in Syria and played an enormous role there.
As U.S. troops continue to pull back, Russia is moving in, reaching a deal with Turkey on control of Kurdish territory.
And so for many years, ISIS tried to target Russia. There were regular arrests. There were smaller attacks. There were bomb attacks on airliners.
The Russian passenger jet falling out of the sky over Egypt, killing all 224 on board.
But we never saw a huge attack like this until now.
How clear was it that ISIS might have been planning something like this? Because the idea that the U.S. apparently warned Russia about this possibility is kind of wild to me.
So just at the start of March, there was this very unusual warning from the State Department saying very specifically that there was the threat of extremist attacks on concerts in Moscow. And the U.S. says that it shared intelligence with Russia around that time and before that there was this threat from ISIS and that ISIS was planning similar attacks. And this warning was extremely unusual because of how specific it was. Other countries also joined in that warning. Russia now is claiming it didn't have any specific intelligence from the U.S. I think the U.S. will contest that. Russian authorities so far have completely ignored the ISIS claim or the ISIS connection. Instead, what we saw was Vladimir Putin, 24 hours after the attack, gave his first video address on the attack. And he didn't mention ISIS at all. And instead, he seemed to try and suggest, without quite saying it directly, that Ukraine somehow bore responsibility for the attack. He said that the men had been detained while trying to cross into Ukraine. And he claimed that there had somehow been a crossing prepared from inside Ukraine. And then he brought up Nazis from World War II. Which obviously you might ask, why does that have any place here? And that's because Vladimir Putin refers all the time to the government of Ukraine as Nazis. Allies of Putin have been much less subtle about it. You know, the editor of Russia Today came out and said it bluntly and accused Ukraine of being behind the attack and also accusing the US of being behind the attack. And there are lots of, obviously, conspiracy theories circulating online. Some people think this could even have been a false flag attack organized by the Kremlin to try and mobilize support for the war in Ukraine. But there's another possibility as well, that this was, as it or does appear, a real ISIS attack, but that the Kremlin basically doesn't want to acknowledge that and try and turn what has been a devastating failure of its security services and try and turn that instead into something useful for it and to try and mobilize Russian society against Ukraine.
Right, because we've talked before about how Putin has really avoided acknowledging terror attacks in Russia at all before. He declared victory over ISIS like several years ago. Clearly, this doesn't fit in with that storyline. Patrick Reeval, covering Russia as always. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Next up on Start Here, could a bipartisan compromise cost the new House Speaker his job? We'll go to Washington after the break. With daylight saving time upon us, we're looking forward to more daylight and longer days from March through November, and while setting our clocks forward gives us the illusion of more time, it doesn't necessarily help businesses find qualified candidates any sooner. Fear not, there is a solution. ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter is your 24/7 hiring partner working tirelessly to connect you with the right candidate. Once you post your job on ZipRecruiter, it gets distributed to over 100 job sites, ensuring you reach a diverse pool of qualified individuals. Their smart technology scans thousands of resumes, matching you with people whose skills perfectly align with your job requirements. Spring forward with a new hiring partner, ZipRecruiter, and find top talent sooner. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free, ZipRecruiter.com/start here. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/start here. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Remember when President Biden put out his proposed budget for this year? Everyone kind of chuckled because Congress never actually passed the budget for last year. The only reason there wasn't a government shutdown over all this was because they kept signing these continuing resolutions, they're called, these little extensions that just extend the argument. At one point, we did think there was a deal while conservative Republicans rebelled, kicking out their own Speaker of the House in the process, installing a new one, and igniting the same fight all over again. Well, this weekend, it finally came to an end. Congress passed a $1.2 trillion spending bill averting a government shutdown, but this is also creating chaos in the GOP. ABC's Ali Pekorn is here to fill us in. So, Ali, this was really it, right? This wasn't an extension. This is like the actual thing. It's done.
This is the actual thing. For the next 6 months, everyone will graciously not get to hear you and I talking about how we are on the cusp of a government shutdown. Congress has fully funded its budget until the end of September. That's the end of the fiscal year. As you noted, though, it took them 6 extra months to do this. So while we are taking a celebration lap, we're also at a place where it's like 6 months for a full year budget. Thankfully, they are done. This was wrapped up in the very early morning hours of Saturday.
But wait, so I don't get what's different, because if 6 months ago, Democrats and Republicans worked together to craft a compromise bill, the hardcore Republicans said, this is so terrible, we're going to get rid of our speaker. Why is it okay for those Republicans now?
Yeah, it's not. It's not okay now. In fact, it's perhaps more chaotic than it's ever been. Here's the breakdown. When Congress acted this weekend, basically what had to happen there is House Speaker Mike Johnson had to make some tough choices about what he wanted to do. Did he want to keep the government open, or did he want to keep his far-right GOP flank satisfied? He made a decision.
I think the final product is something that we were able to achieve a lot of key provisions in and wins and a move in the direction that we want, even with our tiny, historically small majority.
He's keeping the government open, even if it irritates some of his far-right members. If that sounds familiar to you, that's because that's exactly what happened 6 months ago when Kevin McCarthy, who was the Speaker of the House at the time, made the same exact call. He really, really irritated his members, and they stripped him of his role. Well, now Speaker Johnson's made a pretty similar calculus, and he is facing pretty similar threats.
This funding bill passed without the majority of the majority. This was a Democrat bill. This is a Chuck Schumer bill.
So on Friday, Marjorie Taylor Greene, she is a pretty well-known person in the House of Representatives for causing chaos. She likes to be a voice that sort of is oppositional. She's a member of the far-right House Freedom Caucus. Marjorie Taylor Greene, she comes running out of the House chamber after having voted against this government funding bill, and she lets journalists know she's done something that is going to cause a lot of chaos in the House. She's going to try to get rid of Speaker Johnson.
Today I filed a motion to vacate after Speaker Johnson has betrayed our conference and broken our rules.
She's filed what's called a motion to vacate. Basically, that's something where members can say, we have lost faith and confidence in our speaker, and we want to get rid of him and get him out of this role. Mm. And because Johnson decided to move forward with this spending bill, she decided that she was going to pull the trigger on that and file this motion. It's a little bit different than what happened with McCarthy, though. She's not necessarily saying she wants to have the vote. She just wants Johnson on notice that she's ready to remove him at any time.
And what are the actual, like, what's the beef? It's like you're working with Democrats instead of us. Like, what is, say, a Marjorie Taylor Greene or some of these far-right Republicans, what would they like to have happen instead?
Yeah, Marjorie Taylor Greene's primary issues with Mike Johnson at this particular moment have to do with the way that he moved this spending bill through the House. So, first of all, Johnson shirked what is called the 72-hour rule, which is something that says that he's going to give his members 72 hours to read these big bills before he asks them to vote on it.
Okay.
Because Johnson didn't want to shut the government down, he said that he was going to dispense with that rule, and he forced his members to vote on this bill a little over 24 hours after it was released. That annoyed Marjorie Taylor Greene. Now, you might be thinking that's probably not enough to remove someone from a speakership, and you're right. But Greene's bigger issue here has to do with the actual contents of the funding bill. Now, she and many Republican members feel like Johnson didn't do the things that he said he was going to do with this bill. She wanted more spending cuts. She wanted the bill to cost a lot less than it did. She also wanted policy riders that would have addressed the crisis that she sees going on at the southern border. She says that there's not enough here to shore up the border and keep the country safe. And so because of all of those things, she's decided it's time to get rid of Johnson. Now, the reason why that she doesn't want to hold a vote on this right away is because if you get rid of Mike Johnson, there's not an extremely obvious successor.
This has just been a cluster, a mistake, and it has harmed not just the party, but the nation.
When Kevin McCarthy lost his job, you'll remember the House of Representatives was thrown into chaos for 3 full weeks as they struggled mightily to find someone who could get the requisite support to replace him.
That process allows everyone to have discussions and internal meetings and conversations. And it allows other people to step forward and say they're willing to run for Speaker.
So Marjorie Taylor Greene is saying that she wants Johnson on notice while there's some conversations behind the scenes about who could realistically get the support needed to fill his role.
And what makes this all so interesting is because of all the dysfunction right here, we're seeing Republican members like get out of Dodge. Just on Friday, Mike Gallagher from Wisconsin now says he will leave his seat in Congress next month. That's the latest in the slew of retirements, which taken together mean that for months now, Republicans will have such a slim majority that they can only manage one defection on any given bill. Otherwise, Democrats going to be able to override anything they want to do. Allie Pecorin in Washington, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brad.
You know what was actually kind of remarkable about the discourse around Princess Kate in England over these last couple months? It wasn't really driven by the infamous British tabloids. Instead, it was social media, TikTok, Instagram, where speculation about her whereabouts spread like wildfire. After all, she hadn't been seen in public for months after a mysterious surgery. The only video available was grainy, and Kensington Palace eventually admitted the only available photo of her had been edited. So with the king in questionable health, what was going on with the next potential British queen? Well, on Friday, perhaps in response to all this, Kate put out a video to update the British public about her condition. And it was here where she announced she's got cancer. ABC's foreign correspondent Maggie Rooley is based in London. Maggie, I mean, can you walk me through this video?
Yeah, Brad, I have to, the first thing when we found out that there was going to be a video released and that it was from the Princess of Wales and she was going to announce that she had cancer, I mean, honestly, the entire office was in shock. No one saw this coming. And I think that's kind of what the country and the world felt. This wasn't the ending to this saga that people anticipated. And I think it stopped a lot of people cold in their tracks.
I wanted to take this opportunity to say thank you personally for all the wonderful messages of support and for your understanding whilst I've been recovering from surgery.
Here you have Princess Catherine releasing this video, and it's a really intimate, personal video. She's sitting on a bench, what looks like some type of park. She's in a casual striped sweater, wearing jeans, and she went into what happened.
In January, I underwent major abdominal surgery in London, and at the time, it was thought that my condition was non-cancerous. The surgery was successful. However, tests after the operation found cancer had been present.
Because, Brad, if you remember, this all started back in January when Kate went into what she calls in the video major abdominal surgery. And she says at the time, she believed, and they all believed, that it was non-cancerous. And that's the statement that Kensington Palace sent out. Now, she says it wasn't until post-operative tests came back, pathology came back, that it was revealed she had had cancer.
This, of course, came as a huge shock. And William and I have been doing everything we can to process and manage this privately for the sake of our young family.
And that in February, after she had recovered from this surgery, she was able to start preventative chemotherapy. And that's kind of where we're at now. And she just shared all of this. She thanked people for their support, and she ends by even reaching out to others, people that have cancer, other people and families who are dealing with cancer. And she just ended simply by saying, "You are not alone."
What is the prognosis? What's the diagnosis? Like, what type of cancer does she have?
Kensington Palace has just asked for privacy, full stop. They're not saying what type of cancer. They're not saying what stage the cancer is. They're not really explaining preventative chemotherapy. You know, plenty of doctors have kind of gone in headfirst about what this could mean, and you can speculate one way or the other. But the honest answer is that right now we actually just have no idea, Brad.
She never really addressed all the speculation directly. She never said something like, you know, what's wrong with you conspiracy theorists? Or like, see, like, I'm here, nothing to worry about. But I mean, was this the royal family trying to address some of that by putting this out? now in a video form.
Yeah, Brad, I mean, obviously Kensington Palace was aware of all of these conspiracy theories online, all of this speculation. I think everyone in the world, it seems, was aware of some of these rumors. So putting out this video, they knew what they were doing.
We hope that you'll understand that as a family, we now need some time, space, and privacy while I complete my treatment.
And they knew that people were going to use this to either, you know, further fuel conspiracy theories, or could it shut down these conspiracy theories? And I think that's part of the reason we saw from Princess Kate herself. You know, she didn't use a spokesperson. This wasn't just a statement that was put out. I mean, if you remember, the king put out a statement about his cancer diagnosis. He didn't release a personal video. So the fact that Kate went out there and released this personal video was really her telling the world in her own words what she had been through. I mean, we also understand that she wrote this all herself. So she's really trying to convey to people that these are her own words, her own feelings, her own emotions, her own problems and troubles and issues right now and fears. And she wants to share that with people.
Taped by the BBC, right? Like this time the photo credit was not the palace or William or Kate or someone.
Exactly, exactly. So they were trying to have, you know, a very credible source. Mm. They went through sort of all of the traditional media channels. They gave the media a 2 hours heads up embargo on this so that everyone could be in place to report this properly. I mean, it was an incredibly well thought out process as well. And I think that was important for the palace to sort of try to take charge of the narrative again. Clearly, it had kind of gotten out of control.
We knew that she'd been in hospital, you know, and we'd seen that. And there seemed to be a long quiet period. And I had thought to myself, I'd wondered if something was more serious.
I think she should be just left alone to get on and have a treatment and to be with her family.
Now you can sort of see why. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think Kate says this herself in the video, but she needed time to process this news. She needed time to tell her husband and have them process the news. And then they had to tell their three little kids, and they had to have time to process this news. Because, you know, Kate's only 42 years old. She has three kids under the age of 10. That's a lot for any family to deal with. I feel as if that part can be seen as genuine, right? Like anyone would have to need time to get their thoughts together before presenting it to the public. And that was really the message that the palace wanted to get across.
It wasn't a good sort of news to actually break at this stage, but I think her hand was forced, really.
And Brad, something we've been seeing online is people expressing their regret over some of their flippant posts that they made about Kate's health now that she came out saying that she has cancer. But Brad, what's interesting is that the one very real issue people are now talking about, which we're seeing quite evidently playing out, is that the royal family has limited numbers of senior royals right now. I mean, think about this, Brad. You have the king, King Charles, diagnosed with cancer, undergoing cancer treatment. He's not taking on many official duties right now. He's really taking a step back. You have the Princess of Wales, Princess Catherine, who's also has taken full steps back. She's not working right now. You have her husband, the Prince of Wales, Prince William, who has said he's taking time off until after the Easter holidays to be with his family. So he's off for the next 2 weeks. I mean, Brad, who do you have left? Right now, all of a sudden, Queen Camilla is the star of the royal family. She has multiple engagements this week. She's the only one that is really the face of this royal family right now. So not only is it a lot of pressure on the limited number of working royals that you have left, but all of a sudden, you're not able to do as much. So to be down all of a sudden to only one working royal, who is Queen Camilla, I mean, honestly, I think no one saw this coming.
Yeah, really interesting, because these are the heads of state, right? These are the heads of the British state. Now they're nowhere to be seen. And once, you know, back in the day, Queen Elizabeth once said, you have to be seen to be believed. And that perhaps part of the thinking from the royal family here. All right, Maggie Rooley in London. Thank you.
Thanks, Brad.
Okay, one more quick break. When we come back, the best part of college sports are the bands, even if they're from the wrong school. One last thing is next.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
And one last thing.
yesterday wrapped up the first weekend of March Madness. Taken together, the men's and women's tournaments constitute the single biggest gambling event in America. And on the men's side, there were tons of upsets.
For the first time in 41 years, James Madison advances to the second round of the NCAA tournament.
On CBS, we saw tiny James Madison University beat Wisconsin. Oakland University over in Michigan knocked off mighty Kentucky, and 13 seed Yale, yes, the Ivy League champs, took down Auburn.
Yale riding the March Magic high once again!
Some of the most excited people in that arena don't go to Yale at all.
Y-A-L-E, Yale! Bulldogs, Bulldogs, arf, arf!
That is the marching band from the University of Idaho, who was not playing that night. But you see, Yale's pep band had a scheduling conflict. They couldn't come to Spokane, Washington, and U of I is just an hour and a half away. So within hours of the bracket being posted, Yale put out a request to the Idaho band director asking, can you guys fill in? And Idaho took it seriously.
We got the music this morning, so I mean, we learned it, and I think we sound pretty good.
These musical volunteers had one practice, the day of the game. They learned the Yale fight song, they asked the cheer squad for extra input, and they wore Yale colors in the arena. They're usually known as the Idaho Vandals, but in honor of the Yale Bulldogs, they dubbed themselves the Vandogs for the day. Well, when Yale started mounting a challenge to the SEC champions, the band members started getting legit psyched. Players on the court described themselves as confused. They were told they wouldn't have a band. So who were all these trumpet players screaming every time they scored a basket? Well, after this thrilling victory, Yale's head coach admitted this crowd, with the band leading them, had helped swing momentum in their favor. It also guaranteed the Vandogs a repeat performance last night in round two. And these schools could not be more different. One is a rural campus, well known for its agriculture program. The other, in New Haven, is the third oldest college in this country. But now, they will always have a kinship forged purely by the madness of March. By the way, if you're wondering, not a single men's bracket submitted to ESPN.com is still intact at this point. And in the ABC News pool, I am currently 45th out of 200, which is okay. I'm ahead of Jonathan Carl. That's good. I'm ahead of my boss, Liz Alessi, which I guess I should stop talking about at this exact moment. We just need the Vandogs playing our song. Then we'll go on a run right here, right now. I'm Brad Milkey. I'll see you tomorrow.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.